Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
The topic of my talk tonight is justification in Thomas and Luther, and particularly the way that both of them take a stand against the Pelagians. I'm going to try to focus somewhat on the similarities between Thomas and Luther, though by the end, I'll be talking more about their differences. Before I get into the substance of the talk, I wanted to begin by saying that my goal, my kind of simple goal for this talk, has been to encourage a certain amount of ecumenical dialogue by getting Catholics among you to read and think about Martin Luther, and by getting Protestants among you, whom I learned in the ride over are a significant majority around here, somewhat to my surprise. I thought it was going to be 50-50. Apparently not. Getting some of you to read and take seriously the ideas of Thomas Aquinas. I think it's a wonderful thing that the Thomistic Institute, this organization of which I've been, which has been such a wonderful home for me, has a presence at such a strongly Protestant campus. Seems to me that there are some real threads in the Christian intellectual tradition shared across sects that are important to recognize and encourage. And today I want to talk about at least some of those and give some indication of some of the shared space. I should say, and I'll try to give some evidence for this over the course of the talk, that I am of the opinion that on many issues, the differences between Thomas Aquinas and Martin Luther are somewhat exaggerated. Luther's polemics against scholastics, I think, should be understood as directed primarily against late scholasticism, less read, the kind of thing that was practiced and taught at the University of Wittenberg when Luther was there. So without denying that there are important differences between the two, I do want to encourage a kind of awareness of the similarities. Now, to be fair, honesty compels me to begin by noting something about what the two actually said about one another, and I must say it is not in every case friendly. Now, Thomas, as you might guess, never addressed the writings of Martin Luther directly. Despite his considerable theological gifts, he was not able to predict the coming of Martin Luther 250 years later, and so there is no specific response to Martin Luther's writings that one can find in Thomas's Summa or elsewhere. You can laugh at things like that. That's the kind of joke that I usually tell, so if you would do me the favor of smiling a little bit when I say something like that, it'll make me feel much more at home. Anyway, that said, right, the Council of Trent of 1546 condemns aspects of Lutheranism and Luther's teaching quite resoundingly, and so far as I can tell, the position of the council is the same as the position of Thomas. Luther, on the other hand, did note Thomas's writings, but he actually does not speak that often about them. I acknowledge that when he does speak about them, he does not exactly speak about them favorably. I'll quote just one passage. This is taken from Luther's lectures on Genesis, and I quote here, speaking about theologians who had studied and learned from Aristotle and Averroes, he blames them for having given rise to, quote, the Thomases, the Scotuses, and other monstrosities. That's not one of the very worst things he ever said about Thomas Aquinas. That said, as mentioned, Luther does not refer to Thomas too often by name. He usually attacks the schoolmen or the scholastics. And schoolmen or scholastics is a massive school of thought, right? It's like talking about classical liberals. My own background is largely in, originally, I should say, in political philosophy. And if you talk about classical liberals, you can be speaking about figures as diverse as John Locke, Montesquieu, Benjamin Constant. There are piles of them. And while it's not right to attribute any one position to all of them, I mean, I would say there is a certain logic in using the term scholasticism is somehow identifiably a thing, but much of what Luther attributes to the late scholastics, especially when he accuses them of Pelagianism, seems to me better directed against some of the later figures. To offer just one piece of evidence, in Luther's famous, but not quite as famous as the other theses, 97 theses that he posted in September of 1517, his so-called disputation against scholastic theology, Luther mentions by name only John Duns Scotus and Gabriel Beale. Thomas Aquinas doesn't appear at all. So my suggestion is that there's a lot of common ground between them, more than Luther's polemics against scholasticism would occasionally lead one to think. Now, in order to try to articulate what that common ground is, I thought it would be appropriate to look at the views of Thomas and Luther on Pelagianism. That seemed appropriate to me for two reasons. The first is that Pelagianism, and I'll explain what that is in the next section of the talk if it's not familiar, but Pelagianism, the questions surrounding Pelagianism deal with the central theme of the Reformation, which is justification. So it's the point where you would expect the divergences, it's at least a way of looking at the point at which you would expect the divergences between Thomas and Luther to be the greatest and the strongest. The second reason I wanted to talk about Pelagianism is that it seems to me that it's there that followers of Thomas and Luther can make a kind of common cause against certain trends of the modern world. I'll mention briefly a provocation made by a certain contemporary political theorist. This is someone, Eric Nelson at Harvard, if you're curious, right, makes the claim that modernity, in important and liberal modernity, in the sense of classical liberal modernity specifically, is in many ways Pelagian in intention. I'll read a line from his book to that effect. Quote, liberalism, or the cluster of commitments defended by those we tend to identify as proto-liberals, from Milton and Locke to Rousseau and Kant, was at bottom the theological position known as Pelagianism. Nelson's claim is very radical. I will admit I do not share it in every respect. But I will say that it seems to me there's something to it. If you read the theological works of John Locke, there are certain arguments that I would say are identifiably Pelagian. And further, it seems to me that the thoughts underlying Pelagianism are more prominent now than they've ever been. It's something I see in my own teaching, my interactions with students, and if I'm honest, in my own formation, certain arguments made by the Pelagians that you grow up taking for granted in some ways, things that you thought before you ever thought about what you thought, if that makes sense. So as one point of unity between Thomists and Lutherans, I suggest that there is a shared sense that something is amiss in the modern world that could be corrected by a return to a more adequate, for Thomas and Luther, a more authentically Christian understanding, an anti-Pelagian understanding of justification. So in the rest of the talk, I'm going to proceed in three basic parts. First, and this will be sort of a Pelagianism 101 bit, I'm just going to say a little about what Pelagianism is, using a few quotes from Pelagius and Augustine, its great opponent. Second, I'm going to talk about common ground that Thomas and Luther had, on the basis of which each opposed in different ways the Pelagians. And then thirdly, because I don't think I could do a talk like this honestly without addressing it, I will say something about the big differences between the two. And while I'll argue that they're somewhat more muted than appears, they're real, and I won't deny that. So, big part one, Pelagianism. Pelagius, as you may or may not know, was a British theologian. He lived from about 354 to 418 in the year of our Lord. The doctrine that bears his name was regarded as the great heresy in the church in the 5th century. He's most famously the opponent of Saint Augustine, who devoted quite a few writings. And Augustine, of course, is one of the most prolific church fathers, one of the most prolific Christian authors we've seen. He devoted quite a few books to the refutation of Pelagianism. And if you're participating in our seminar tomorrow, we'll be looking at one that was directed against Pelagians, the on perseverance. Augustine was responsible for calling the Council of Carthage in 418, at which the core Pelagian doctrines were condemned. We have some of Pelagius's writings available, the most interesting of which to me is his commentary on Paul's letter to the Romans, and we have some long statements by St. Augustine explaining the position and other statements by contemporaries. I'm going to rely mostly on, I'm going to be brief here, so I'm going to rely mostly on what Augustine says and a little bit on what Pelagius says in his own names. In his own name, rather. So to begin with, at heart, Pelagianism is the teaching that human beings, without the aid of divine grace, are able to live sinlessly, and in that way can be made worthy of salvation. In that sense, the core Pelagian claim is a claim about the Christian notion of justification. Now, that term justification is, I suppose, I actually don't know if you know this or not, so I'll just say it. Term justification is widely used because St. Paul appeals to it often in his letters. It's especially associated with Paul's letters. It's a great theme of Christian faith in all of its forms, Christian theology in all of its forms, arguably the great theme of Christian theology. It means literally, justification means literally to make righteous or to make just. The Greek word dikaiosune is the word for justice, right? And though the translations vary from point to point, justice, righteousness, justification, which is just from justice, in the Greek, they all come from that single word, dikaiosune or dike, which means to be made righteous. So the problem that's faced by Christians is how human beings can be made righteous, right, can be made just, and therefore become, or at least be counted as righteous, so that they are fit to be saved, right, fit for salvation from God, right? The famous and hotly contested Pelagian doctrine is that justification, right, being made righteous, is possible even absent any direct intervention of God's grace. Or to put the point differently, that human beings, by their own free choices, by choices made through their own free will, are capable of acting rightly and so being deemed worthy of salvation. Here, I quote the description of his teaching in St. Augustine's Treatise of Heresies. And I believe this is the first quote, if I'm remembering right. Do you all have a little handout? Yeah, so this, I think, is the first quote on your handout. I gave them all to you. The first two are biblical quotes, but those are not, I'm not going to read those out. Those are just for reference. So Augustine writes, they, that is the Pelagians or the followers of Pelagius, are enemies of this grace of God to such an extent that they believe that a human being can observe all of God's commandments without it. Yet, he goes on, if this were true, there would have been no point in the Lord's saying, without me you can do nothing. He quotes John 15:5 to that effect. Pelagius sees God's grace, sees all specific gracious intervention into the life of a sinner as something that is not needed for the sake of salvation. He will occasionally use the term grace to refer to the human capacity to will things freely, or the innate human capacity for righteousness, but he never says what I'll say Thomas and Luther say, that God's specific gracious intervention in the life of the sinner is necessary for a person to become justified, for a person to be made righteous. The argument that Pelagius provides for this claim is double. On the one hand, it has to do, it's probably more than double, but it's at least double, right? First, he makes scriptural arguments for this. I'll say a little bit about those later. I tend to view them as stretches, and I'll talk about how Thomas and Luther respond. To me, the more interesting argument that he makes is the one that has to do with theodicy. That is, with what he believes to be necessary to think about God and God's grace if you are to understand God as a just being, God himself as a righteous being. And I wanted to bring out these arguments because it seems to me that these, especially, again, I hear these arguments all the time from my students, right? Students who have never read, who have never picked up a theological treatise in their life. And so I have a sense that these arguments have a power that goes beyond the fact that they were articulated by a smart heretic, you know, a 1.5 millennia ago, right? So I'm going to quote now a couple of passages in which Pelagius makes this case. The first one is from a text of his entitled Of Nature. That text we don't have in its entirety. Augustine, however, in his treatise on nature and grace, quotes from it extensively, and there's actually a little dispute over whether this is a paraphrase or a quote, but I am inclined to understand what I'm about to read out as a quote from Pelagius. So he writes, and I think this is a quote on your sheet also, but I'm not sure. Does someone have an extra sheet, actually? So I don't have to, we'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Okay. For God is not unjust, so that he cheats the righteous out of the reward of their righteousness. If the mystery and divinity of Christ that was revealed in the flesh had not been preached to them, for how are they to believe what they had not heard? Or how are they to hear without someone to preach to them? Don't worry about it. But what about before this preaching finally reaches the ends of the whole earth? After all, there are still remote peoples, though very few, it is said, to whom the word has not yet been preached. What is human nature to do? Or what did it do? For it either previously had not heard that this event would take place, or still has not found out that it's taken place. What is human nature to do but believe in the God who made heaven and earth, the God whom it naturally perceives as its maker, and by living correctly fulfills his will, though it has not received any instruction in the faith concerning the suffering and resurrection of Christ. Thank you. Maybe you really didn't have to do that, but thank you. Okay. Yeah, good. So you can see I quoted a little more. No, that's not the quote. The quote that I did give you was this second one from the letter to Demetrius. But the I actually won't read that out since you have that in front of you. But I will just say that the nub of this argument is that in order to understand God as just, it is necessary from Pelagius's point of view that he, as it were, extend the opportunity of salvation to everybody. And even those, he says, who have not heard of Jesus, they did that not through any fault of their own, but because of how they were born or where they were born. And therefore, he thinks it must be the case that if God is to be understood as just, they too must have the potential to become righteous and worthy of salvation by their own power. I will actually read at least the beginning of this next quote, which is as follows. This is the letter to Demetrius, which you have. We make the God of knowledge guilty of twofold ignorance, of not knowing what he has made and of not knowing what he has commanded. As if in forgetfulness of human frailty, which he made, he had laid upon men commandments which they could not bear, and at the same time, oh, the shame of it, we ascribe unrighteousness to the just one and cruelty to the holy one. First, by complaining that he has commanded something impossible, and next, by thinking that a man will be condemned by him for things that he could not help. So that, sacrilegious it is even to hint it, God seems to have been seeking not so much our salvation, but our punishment. Right? In other words, right, Pelagius's claim is that a righteous and holy God would never dispense grace in the manner that Augustine, Thomas, and Luther will all claim that he did. Right? So, again, I bring this out not because I think the argument is weak, but because I think it has a certain compelling power to it. Nevertheless, that is what is regarded as the great heresy of the 5th century. That is arguably one of the great heresies of our age, and it is a heresy against which Thomas and Luther both protest strongly. So in the next section, two of the talk, I want to lay out some of the way in which Thomas and Luther take a stand against the Pelagians. So, to begin, Thomas and Luther, in what they say, in the way they use the term, are both very strong opponents of the Pelagians. For Thomas, that meant, above all, that in his presentation of his understanding of justification, he was at pains to refute the Pelagians. He mentions them occasionally in the Summa Theologiae. You see it even more clearly in the account of justification in the Summa Contra Gentiles, where a full 7 chapters end with condemnations of some error or other. I would say they end up very, very close as the errors that they are, some error or other of the Pelagians. Luther, too, attacks the Pelagians repeatedly. He goes so far as to suggest, in his colloquy with Erasmus and in many of his other writings, that the church of his day had fallen back into a kind of Pelagianism. Indeed, in some writings, he says the Pelagianism of his day was worse because it was less honest than old-fashioned Pelagianism. For reasons that I will give as I proceed, I do not think that this claim can rightly include the thought of Thomas Aquinas. So let me start out with the parts of the Critique of Pelagius that these two figures unambiguously share, things I think no one would argue about or doubt. Both Thomas and Luther argue that grace is necessary for living a moral life and necessary for salvation in a way that Pelagius denies. Both claim that fulfilling God's commandments is not even possible at least not in every case, not consistently for a human being, without the specific aid of God's grace. People cannot become worthy of salvation without God's grace. To use technical terminology, it's not possible for any human being to merit salvation without the specific intervention of God's grace. But why not? The answer, in a nutshell, and the thing on which Thomas and Luther take a very clear stand against the Pelagians, is the notion of original sin. I want to underline, the part of this talk that's meant to be a response to modernity, in a nutshell, I would say that human beings today do not have a sense of original sin in the way that Thomas and Luther did, and that's a change, right? And that's why Pelagianism is now a kind of, I mean, not exactly Pelagianism, but a kind of decayed, modified Pelagianism is, in my opinion, such a great temptation, right? We have such a strong view of individualism, I think, that this notion can be difficult to grasp. So what is meant by original sin? And what is the notion of original sin that Thomas and Luther share, right? So original sin, first of all, is a consequence of what Adam did in the garden, but it is not that action itself. Thomas usually uses the phrase first man's sin to refer to the specific thing done by Adam, and original sin to mean something related but somewhat different, right? Original sin, for both Thomas and Luther, is a facet of human nature, right? It's something intrinsic to human beings as they are now. In that sense, right, both of them say that Adam's transgression had a much greater effect on human beings than Pelagius said. Pelagius describes Adam's transgression as an example. The phrase is, by the example of Adam's disobedience, many have sinned. Thomas and Luther's notion is much more robust. First, right, original sin. First, two components I want to note. First, original sin, for both Thomas and Luther, includes the fact that human beings are now so tempted by evil, so inclined toward sin, that they are not able to act righteously of their own power, right? They are literally unable to fulfill all of the commandments by themselves or by the choice of their free will. We are fallen for them in a literal sense. The second issue, and it's comprised as a part of the same term, is the notion of original guilt, right? That human beings are born not only with an inclination to do things that are wrong, but are, in a way, literally born guilty. Thomas uses the terminology, uses the vivid image of the stain of sin that gets passed down through the generations. Somehow what Adam did in breaking God's commandments affects everybody so that they need to be cured, right? For Thomas and for Luther, this applies to every human being who was ever born, save one, right? And as it happens, this is perhaps less to their credit from a certain point of view, but both Thomas and Luther do deny the Immaculate Conception. So Mary is not an exception for even for Thomas. She's purified later, but she's not an exception of being born without original sin even there. That's less important. The more topical issue is that all human beings somehow are born guilty, right? Both inclined towards sinfulness and guilty. How does this make sense, that human beings are sinful from the start? What is the understanding of human nature that makes us think that that's so. Augustine in the Confessions has a lovely depiction of this when he talks about the inclinations of babies, right? And says that far from being such sweet creatures and so innocent and naive and wonderful as we are inclined to think they are in many ways the worst beings in the world. And we only think that they are so sweet because they are very weak, right? And they're not very strong. I think of this sometimes, this is not part of the lecture, but I think of this sometimes. I have a babysitting job at the moment, and the two-year-old among these children will run up to me sometimes when he sees me and start flailing at me with both hands and punching me. And it crosses my mind that if this were an 18-year-old, that would be less cute. Let's put it that way. There's something, the thought is that there's something in original, but Augustine's serious thought, using that as his example, is there's something in original, innate human nature, right? And what we're born into that makes us inclined, that makes human beings inclined to do evil or transgressive things. G.K. Chesterton, you may know, has a lovely quip in his book Orthodoxy, where he writes, quote, "Certain new theologians dispute original sin, which is the only part of Christian theology which can really be proved." The bon mot doesn't settle the issue, but you can see visibly in front of you, I think, the inclination that human beings have towards sinfulness, and it's something, again, here on a more serious level, St. Paul suggests is ineradicable from your own heart. There's probably no portrait of this more compelling than the one that he paints in Romans 7 of struggling against his lower inclinations with his higher inclinations. And while theologians will argue whether that's Paul pre-grace or post-grace, and we don't need to settle that issue tonight, it's a very compelling, human, and powerful portrait of what it means to be aware of our own sinfulness, right? And what it means to feel as though, and to not just feel as though, but recognize rationally that we are in need of a cure, right? To this suggestion, this kind of what I would call an experiential case for original sin, Luther and Thomas add strong scriptural arguments. Here I've included what I take to be on the handout. I've included what I take to be the most important statement in favor of the doctrine of original sin in the New Testament on the handout. It's Romans chapter 5, especially verse 12 and 19, right? That through Adam, all have sinned, right? Not just all are susceptible to death, but somehow all have sinned. I'll read a few lines that Luther wrote about this, right? So Luther wrote, and this is drawn from On the Enslaved Will, and it is included on your handout, so I'll just read a touch from this. Since we are all under sin and damnation by the offense of a single man, Adam, he cites Romans, the relevant passage, how can we attempt anything that is not sinful and damnable? For when he says all, he makes no exceptions, not for the power of free will, not for any doer of works. Whether he endeavors or not, he is necessarily included among all the others. And we would not sin or be damned by the single offense of Adam if it were not also our offense. For who would be damned by the offense of someone else, especially in the eyes of God, right? Thomas shares this same notion. I don't have quotes for him, but he has the same. You can look at Summa Theologiae, Primo Secundi, questions 81, 82, 83, but Thomas comes to the same position on these issues. So, claim number one, Lutherans and Thomists together should be, at least, at pains to recover a strong notion of original sin as a part of human nature in their account of anthropology. Second claim, right, the two agree in saying that the escape from the state of sin for human beings requires grace, requires a specific movement that must be initiated by God. And nothing that any human being does can possibly, for either Luther or, and this is the one I really want to hit because this is what I think gets missed sometimes, or for Thomas, can do anything that will merit God's grace, right? So Thomas writes here, this is Summa Theologiae, Prima Secundae, question 109, article 6, I quote, "Man cannot prepare himself to receive the light of grace except by the gratuitous help of God moving him inwardly," right? Neither Thomas nor Luther thinks a human being can initiate a process by which they become worthy of God's mercy or salvation. Only God himself can initiate such a process. So we have, I would claim, at least a significant area of agreement between the two. In that both say that the moving principle behind justification, the indispensable and sole principle behind it, is God's grace. Right? Now, if one reads Thomas and Luther with even a little bit of care, I think that what I have just said is actually not very controversial, right? That at least they share these big notions. I think it's important to underline it, especially because as denizens of the modern world, we're a little more susceptible to Pelagian arguments, and I at least want to show what it means to take a stand against that. But I said also that I would talk about some of the differences. So in this third and final part of my talk, I'm going to wade a little more deeply into those waters. But I hope that even here I can show that there's some more agreement than is usually recognized. So you could call this part Thomas versus Luther, the last section of this talk. So again, unlikely to be news to anyone who would attend a talk like this on a Monday night that the central issue over which the Reformation was fought, the main event, as it were, that we've been waiting for, is justification. Luther says, famously, justification comes from faith alone, sola fide, and does not come about in any way by human works. Thomas disagrees with this in that he says that charitable acts, acts of charity, charity itself, can constitute merit, and he even regards them as necessary for salvation. Is that not a crucially important difference between Thomas on the one hand and Luther on the other? Well, yes, it is, right? And I can't really deny that honestly, and I don't mean to do that. But I do want to claim that looking at Thomas's full teaching on grace and seeing more carefully the role that charitable acts play in it, and more specifically, what prompts and makes possible charitable acts, shows some more harmony with Luther than one might expect. Right? So I'll start. In fact, the way I would put it is that Thomas has an articulation of the workings of grace that's manifold, that contains different components, that treats grace as something that happens as an instant, but is transformative in multiple ways. And Luther tends to treat the moment of faith for him, right, as the justifying moment, in exclusion of anything else. So let me begin by saying a few words about Luther's justification teaching, right? For Luther, justification is something that is possible through faith, and faith is something that comes to human beings not because of anything they do, not because they've merited anything, but because of God's action alone, right? Faith is not something that human beings are capable of cultivating on their own, absent the movement, the prior movement of grace. Free will, for Luther, is in no way involved in justification. Indeed, for Luther, free will does not exist. A few lines from his writings will help explain this position. In the preface to the Epistle to the Romans, he composed these, Luther late in his life composed a series of prefaces to the New Testament. This was written to Romans separately from the lectures that you might be familiar with. He wrote, quote, "Faith is something that God effects in us," right? Here I refer to your handout. This is taken from The Enslaved Will, or The Bondage of the Will, the colloquy with Erasmus, one of Luther's most famous writings. It's also one of the writings, this is a digression. I will say personally, reading Luther, I sometimes find a little frustrating because he condemns so many of, he often will say things about the uselessness of his writings as a whole, but then he will identify many, many specific writings of his as the one good thing that he wrote, right? So he says something like that about this piece, which is on the bondage of the will. He says something like that about his lectures on the Gospel of John. He said first, like, reading Luther is, do you guys read Luther? Reading Luther is kind of a process, right? I've also soft-pedaled Luther's, I really enjoy reading Luther, but I have soft-pedaled a little for purposes of this lecture, some of the language that Luther tends to use, which I would not have said was appropriate for an occasion like this, but it does show up in this anyway. This is not so important. Luther is wonderful and you should all read him. That was the argument I promised to make at the beginning. Here's what he writes in Bondage of the Will. Saint Paul holds that there is no merit whatever, but that who no merit whatever. Merit is that quality by which one, Thomas's definition of merit is that it's the same thing as being worthy of a reward, right? Luther says there is no such thing as merit whatever, but whoever is justified gratis. Just there, you should probably not render it in Latin. Justified by grace or through grace, and that this is not imputed to anyone, but rather to the grace of God. No act, no work, no quality of a human being can in any way serve to propitiate God so as to make us worthy of salvation. Justification comes sola gratia, only by grace freely given, and only by grace made possible by Christ's sacrifice on the cross. So again, Luther has his famous solis, his famous onlys, only by the cross, only by faith, only by grace, right? There's a limit, as it were, that he paints, right? Now here, I must say, there are some noteworthy differences between Luther and Thomas. Thomas, as I said, offers this manifold account of how grace works, identifying different components in it that may take hold at the same time, but that affect different parts of who we are. Even so, there are certain important similarities with Luther's teaching. First, as I've said already, Thomas holds that the first grace, the grace by which the process of justification begins, is something that is never consequent on any merit. There is no preceding merit when God, you should talk about this vividly, when God comes into your heart, starts to change your view of the world, right? There's nothing that anyone does for Thomas that makes them worthy of that. That is God's free gift. And it's not really thinkable for him that there would be something they would do that would earn them a credit, so to speak, so that God would do something like that for them. Second issue, right? Thomas does, it is true, leave space for something that Luther excludes, and that is free will. Thomas asserts, unlike Luther, that human beings have free will. He even allows that in some ways that free will can be prompted by grace. He even allows, still further, that human beings somehow turn to God by an act of their free will. But it is crucially important for Thomas that the turn to God that makes possible justification and charity can only be occasioned by an action on God's part, right? So I read here again from your handout. Man's turning to God is by free will, and thus man is bidden to turn himself to God. But free will can only be turned to God when God turns it, right? So to put this somewhat differently, for Thomas, what free will is for Thomas is a complicated question. It's a part of our anthropology, our capacity to desire and will and choose as human beings, right? In the state of sin, afflicted with original sin, it's not possible for human beings to choose what's good or, as he puts it here, to turn to God. It's only by an act of grace that that becomes possible. So while Thomas does say that free will exists, does even say that it needs to cooperate with God's promptings, right? He will never say and will emphatically deny that free will by itself could ever make a choice that would make it possible for human beings to become worthy of salvation or worthy of God's grace. In other words, human beings acting only through their own power are not capable of doing anything meritorious, right? And now I'd like to come to the last distinction that I want to draw between Thomas and Luther, and that has to do with the idea of merit. Luther is emphatically opposed to, even repulsed by, the notion of merit, right? The thought that someone could act in such a way that they could make a claim against God, for him, makes no sense. It's to underestimate God's greatness and to overestimate human importance, right? And this, by the way, would be the core response to the Pelagians on the issue of God's justice, right? That justice between God and man doesn't mean the same thing as justice between God and a human being. And so Pelagius's standards of justice don't apply to God in the same way. His merely human standards of justice don't work. But that's not what I want to focus on right now. I want to focus instead on what Thomas says about merit, right? Thomas does talk about merit, does even speak about human beings as being capable of meriting certain things. But for Thomas, they are capable of meriting those things, deserving those things, only when their will has been reshaped by divine grace, right? And when God regards a charitable act, a work, as meritorious, it is only such acts as have been prompted by divine grace. So he says, and this is one of the last quotes on your page now. This is from Summa Prima Secundae 114, Article 1, response to the third objection. Since our action has the character of merit only on the presupposition of divine ordination, right? Only because God has set it up beforehand, it does not follow that God is made our debtor simply, but his own, inasmuch as it is right that his will should be carried out, right? In other words, merit for Thomas does not mean that God owes us something. At least true merit is not God owing human beings something. It is God owing himself something, or to put it differently, God adhering to the order that he himself create it, right? So again, right, it does seem to me that there are differences here, but also that those differences are easily misunderstood, right? And that if one exaggerates those differences, one loses the potential for a healthy ecumenical dialogue between adherents of Thomas's teaching and adherents of Luther's teaching. And I suppose that's what I hope you all took away from this talk, if anything, right? I will just say, I love reading both Thomas and Luther. Thomas is one of the few great teachers I have ever had, right? One of the very few people from whom I've learned the most. His systematic clarity of thought, his learning are matchless. Luther, meanwhile, has this extraordinary passion and liveliness that sometimes might go to excesses, but that makes scripture come alive in a way that, I mean, again, no slight to Thomas, but the living issues in scripture are so evident in every one of Luther's writings, more so than anywhere else I've looked. So I offer these two final suggestions or takeaways. If you're partisan of Luther, right, I recommend Thomas as someone who has remarkable conceptual clarity and a different, maybe subtler than you were inclined to think, understanding of the economy of salvation. For a partisan of Thomas, I would say that Luther's fieriness is something worth learning from, and I wanted to offer just one line, right? From Luther, that it seemed to me, I never read anything quite like it in Thomas, and I found it particularly beautiful, and it seems to me a good reminder, even for those of us who are Thomistically inclined. This is from his commentary on Galatians, right? Luther writes, "Man's weakness and misery is so great that in the terrors of conscience and the dangers of death, we behold nothing else but our works, our worthiness, and the law." In other words, confronted with the problem of death, fact of mortality, challenge of original sin, human beings have, precisely because of their sin, an inclination to put too much stock in their own works, achievements, and ability to abide by the rules, and insufficient stock in God's grace. A fully authentic and self-aware Thomism would be aware, in my opinion, of the need for that grace. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.